This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa, and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin, and here's what's coming up.
We're already witnessing villages, whole villages, shutting down and moving to the nearest urban centers.
That was Amer Daoudi of the World Food Program in Madagascar on the rise of severe malnutrition in the country's south. This story and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. U.S. President Joe Biden is touting a range of accomplishments as he hits the milestone of 100 days in office. But has he made any impact on the African continent? VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
President Biden has focused most of his energy in his first 3 months on taming the coronavirus pandemic on home soil. But in this short, frantic period, he's made a few important gestures that have been welcomed in Africa. On his first day in office, he halted the U.S. plan to exit the World Health Organization. Biden's reversal of predecessor Donald Trump's controversial decision to withdraw from the global body was greeted with near-universal approval, especially from African health experts, who said this could portend a more equitable world order. Biden also pledged an additional $2 billion to the COVAX facility, which aims to provide equitable vaccine access to poorer nations. Then, on April 20th, day 90 of his administration, he spoke words that appeared to resonate with many in Africa as he discussed the death of African-American George Floyd in police custody last year.
We can't leave this moment or look away thinking our work is done. We have to look at it. We have to look as we did for those 9 minutes and 29 seconds. We have to listen. I can't breathe. Those are George Floyd's last words. We can't let those words die with him. We have to keep hearing those words.
Floyd was born in Houston and murdered in Minneapolis. But the African continent watched keenly as a jury earlier in April handed a guilty verdict to his killer, ex-policeman Derek Chauvin. Floyd slowly suffocated while pinned painfully under Chauvin's knee, crying for help and for his loved ones. The incident was a linchpin for protests and calls for police reform in the United States. African analysts such as Asanda Gwasheng, a Cape Town-based diversity trainer and gender and race scholar, welcomed Biden's admission that the U.S. has a racial justice problem. South Africa is also struggling to overcome such issues after centuries of colonialism and the brutal apartheid government. Gwasheng said U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris's status as a powerful black female leader lends weight to Biden's desire to address racial justice. But she says she wants to see more from both the administration and American institutions.
We praise Kamala, and I think it's great that we praise her. But people of color in institutionally racist institutions very rarely are able to make any change. And so unless and until we deal with the systems and the structures that keep prejudice in place, we are not going to see many changes in the United States and globally. And so yay and great for America and Biden, but can we please talk about the institutional change that they are going to make?
Johannesburg-based commentator Brooke Spector said that while Biden hasn't made any big changes to Africa policy, the fact that he isn't making radical, impulsive changes, as critics accuse Trump of doing, is a welcome change in itself. Spector recommends that Biden work to strengthen and maintain the African Growth and Opportunities Act, a U.S. trade program.
Much of what has to happen is going to be demonstrated by doing things on the ground in a slow, steady, consistent pattern rather than these hectic policy changes of chopping and changing. If you want to demonstrate your support for economic growth on the continent, then you carry out the policies that encourage economic growth.
Spector, who served as a U.S. diplomat overseas for several decades, says time will tell in Biden's impact on Africa. Presidential legacies, he said, are built over years, not days, even 100 of them. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Next in Chad, some experts believe that Chadian troops, who contribute significantly to the fight against extremist groups in the Sahel, could be shifting their focus away from regional security while dealing with domestic issues and consolidating power at home. Last year, Nigeria, Chad, and Niger started a joint operation against extremist group Boko Haram and its affiliates. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the impact of any change in Chad's contribution to regional security. Here's a clip of their conversation.
Chad has been an unstable place, and I think this will continue to be the case. I think especially since we've just seen an unconstitutional shift in power where the military has bypassed the constitution and in fact closed down the parliament so that it could appoint Deby's son as the new leader. So it's effectively a coup. And so that can only portend more instability in Chad. That said, we can expect that Chad is going to reassess its commitments in the region, and it is possible that it will pull back from some of these regional security initiatives that it has been supportive. I think the main point, though, is that any regional security strategy that's dependent on an autocratic governance system is inherently unstable. Now, the repression that is needed to keep these regimes in place will inevitably create grievances and pushback. And that is something we've seen in Chad. And that is something that we expected. Even if Deby hadn't died, we would expect that there would continue to be instability there. So I think that is part and parcel of relying on an autocratic government for these regional security efforts.
So could other regional forces join together to prevent an uptick in terrorist group violence?
I think regional security cooperation is very important because these violent extremist groups have thrived in the border areas. Boko Haram and the Islamic State of West Africa have been able to persist because they've been able to go back and forth across the borders with Nigeria, Cameroon, and Chad. And so this provides them something of a safe haven. Regional security cooperation provides opportunities to facilitate coordination, to improve communication, to have agreements for cross-border pursuit of these groups. So it's a very important part of the solution. Chad contributes 2,000 troops to the joint force, the multinational joint task force in the Lake Chad Basin area. And this has been valuable for trying to contain Boko Haram and Islamic State of West Africa.
That was Joseph Siegel of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. The UN Food Program warns that entire villages are shutting down in southern Madagascar due to lack of food. The WFP says that emergency aid is needed for hundreds of thousands to head off a humanitarian disaster on the island's nation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
5 consecutive years of drought, exacerbated by unexpected sandstorms, have depleted people's food stocks, forcing them to resort to desperate measures to survive. The WFP Senior Director of Operations of Madagascar, Ahmed Daoudi, says at least 1.35 million people are suffering from acute hunger, many of whom have nothing to eat and are living off locusts, raw cactus fruits, or wild leaves. He says malnutrition is soaring to alarming levels, putting the lives of many children under age 5 at risk. While on a diplomatic and governmental tour of the region, he says he saw horrific, shocking images of starving, malnourished, and stunted children.
And not only the children. Mothers, parents, and the population in the villages we visited. The situation is extremely, extremely worrisome, scary. They are on the periphery of famine.
The WFP official says most of Madagascar's southern districts are in a nutrition emergency, as acute malnutrition has almost doubled over the last 4 months. He says people are dying, but it is difficult to get an accurate count.
If a child dies, they bury. There is no reporting. There is no official type reporting to take these numbers. Same thing with grown-ups. We're already witnessing villages, whole villages, shutting down and moving to the nearest urban centers.
Daoudi calls this worrisome. noting the growing number of people is putting pressure on an already fragile food security situation in the cities. He says WFP is short of money and limited in what it can do to address this hunger crisis. Because of the cash crunch, he says his agency has been forced to cut food rations by half for up to 750,000 people who are living on a knife's edge. He says WFP needs $75 million immediately to cover the needs of hundreds of thousands of starving people over the next few months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Uganda has reported the presence of the variant of COVID-19 that is spreading fast across India. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The Uganda Virus Research Institute says a recent traveler from India tested positive for the strain. Executive Director Pontiano Kalebu says teams are already doing contact tracing for people who may have interacted with the traveler.
The sample with the Indian strain is a Uganda. Those samples taken off in Malago. We are trying to find out the details. There are people who are doing all those contact tracing.
Caleb has asked the public to continue observing all measures put in place to prevent the spread of COVID-19, noting that the variant spreads very fast and is more deadly than other strains.
I think they're seeing the epidemic in India. Yeah, some people think the epidemic is partly because of this Indian variant, easily transmissible, even infecting young people. That's the worry.
UVRI says 5 COVID variants have been found in Uganda, including those first reported in South Africa, Nigeria, India, and the UK. The health ministry says the country might be forced to come up with measures to control the importation of COVID strains. Diana Atwine is the Health Ministry's permanent secretary.
We are going to meet the Indian Association. We are going to meet the CAA. We are going to meet immigration. We need to come up with a strategy, because we are not sitting, definitely, and we are concerned about these travelers coming back again in the country with all these variants. That means they have a bigger impact on us moving forward. So we have to do something.
The Indian Association has sent out a statement telling members who have just returned from India to go for testing. The new strain comes as reports indicate a decline in the number of new COVID-19 cases in Uganda, which has recorded 642 cases out of 89,089 samples tested since March. India is struggling with a devastating resurgence of COVID-19. Kenya has suspended flights to and from India for 14 days. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Now in Zimbabwe, talks to increase civil servant salaries have been dragging on since the beginning of the year. The country recently reopened schools after COVID-19 lockdowns, but teachers say their meager salaries make it almost impossible. Reporter Kudzai Zvinavashe has the details.
The situation is dire in Zimbabwe. Civil servants have long asked for their incomes to be reviewed, saying their incomes are not enough to live on. Obed Masaraure is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe.
Teachers are in a serious crisis. They cannot even afford to pay school fees for their own children. At schools where they are ordinarily teaching, they can't afford to fund for basics, BT, OTK, food, even shelter itself.
Teachers have long declared that they are overwhelmed and underpaid. Some turn to vending or to offering private lessons paid by parents. But the government has urged them to hold on since talks continue between the government and the Apex Council, which represents the teachers who are considered to be civil servants. The government has offered a 50% increase, but the teachers want their incomes to be paid in a more stable currency, the US dollar. The talks have lasted longer than expected. As a result, some teachers have refused to return to the classroom. Monica Mutsangwa is the Minister of Information.
Cabinet was informed that the number of teachers who are reporting for duty had decreased. It is also further noted that some of those reporting for duty are not teaching the children. Cabinet wishes to reiterate that negotiations for improved conditions of service remain open under the National Joint Negotiating Council, and that the no work, no pay policy will be strictly enforced.
Masaraure says teachers are not moved by such threats.
Teachers have equally declared that if they are not going to be paid, they are not going to be working. That is why they have since declared that they are incapacitated, because the government have already reneged on its mandate of paying a living wage.
He adds that teachers are not going to suffer, but rather the already battered education system will be affected by this move. Parents are banking hopes on ongoing talks and for the education calendar to continue uninterrupted. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashi from Harare.
Now we go to Kenya, where farmers say they are being forced to hand pollinate their crops due to declines in bee populations from pesticides. Insect experts say the chemicals, which were meant to kill desert locusts and other pests, are killing off bees and other helpful pollinating insects. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan farmer Samuel Nderitu says he made a good living from his crops for nearly a decade until 2019, when he noticed neighboring farmers spraying for pests. His crop yields started dropping, says Nderitu, and is convinced it's because the pesticides kill off pollinating insects like bees. He has since been forced to hand pollinate the plants.
It has been quite successful. Not 100% though, because that is not natural. The natural way is where the insects transfer the pollen from one place to another. That's the most successful one. Mm-hmm. But now, because the pollinators are not there, we have to help in that process.
A 2019 desert locust invasion in East Africa forced Kenyan authorities and farmers into a massive spraying campaign to save their crops. But Kenya's International Center of Insect Physiology and Ecology says the unchecked use of pesticides is ironically killing off the pollinators on which the crops depend. Nelly Ndungu is a research scientist at the center.
The pesticides are affecting the health of the bees because the pesticides reduce the immunity of the bees. Now aggravating the effect of pesticides in the varroa mites, and those lack of forage because of climatic conditions and changing climate, all these, they reduce the immunity of the bees and can even eventually cause the bee death and decline in population.
Kenya's agricultural experts are researching pest control options that reduce chemical use. Agricultural research professor Hamadi Boga says biological control using predators that feed on pests is one option.
The biggest challenge is that biological control works ex situ. Ex situ means in the lab. It works very well. But when you take it to the field because of rain, because of other environmental issues, sometimes it's not quite as perfect.
Biodiversity groups are also training Kenya's farmers on how to repel pests without harmful chemicals that can kill pollinators. The national coordinator of the Kenya's Biodiversity Coalition, Anne Maina, explains.
We train them on what we call integrated pest management. For example, if you find that you have a particular pest that is giving you trouble or a disease, how do you plant crops? For example, if you even in your kitchen garden, if you are growing vegetables, we encourage farmers to grow them with things like onions, pepper or pilipili, and these are able to repel some of these pests.
Kenyan farmers like Nderitu hope to one day attract bees to their farms again. Until then, he will have to do the pollinators' work by hand. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
In Cameroon, President Paul Biya has been in power for nearly four decades. He's Africa's oldest and second longest serving leader. Critics of Biya's long rule suspect he is seeking a family dynasty after newly established groups this month started calling for his son Frank to succeed him. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
The most prominent of the four groups asking Frank to replace his father is the Citizens Movement in support of Frank Biya for peace and unity in Cameroon. Its coordinator, Alain Fidel Owona, says the movement was created at the request of young Cameroonians to support a young man to take over from the 88-year-old president. He says his movement supports Frank Biya because of his high sense of patriotism and love for nation.
Ce que nous savons de Frank Emmanuel Biya, c'est quelqu'un de très discret qui travaille pour le Cameroun.
He says Frank is a very serious and discreet young man who works very close to his father, Paul Biya, for the development of Cameroon. He says Frank is very polite, does not squander state resources, and is a trained political scientist, which makes him highly qualified to succeed his father. He says he does not think Frank Biya will be able to decline ceaseless calls from the Cameroonian people to be president. Owona leads groups of young people every weekend to Cameroon towns and villages. He said civilians must be informed that Cameroon will have a peaceful transition only by rallying behind Frank should Paul Biya leave power. Owona said his movement and others calling on Frank to be president are neither influenced by President Biya nor his close collaborators. Secondary school teacher Fidelis Njomo in the city of Douala doesn't believe that and says he opposes the attempt to establish a family dynasty.
Cameroon is not a monarchy. Cameroon is a state of law, and should the 88-year-old Paul Biya dies, the constitution says the president of the Senate, not Frank Biya, takes over leadership. Paul Biya and his supporters should stop this manipulation that is intended to maintain their grip on power.
Frank Biya, who is 49, currently serves as one of his father's advisors, but has not expressed any interest publicly in becoming president. Prudence Yange is a political analyst and visiting lecturer at Ndisamba, a private university in Cameroon. She says the trend in Central African states is for the sons of long-serving leaders to succeed their fathers.
It is as if leaders in Central Africa want to stay in power until they die. And before they die, they prepare their children to take over. Omar Bongo in Gabon handed over to his son Ali Bongo in Chad. Idris Deby died and his son Mohamed Deby wants to succeed him.
Paul Biya, who has been Cameroon's president since 1982, is rarely seen in public these days. Nge said she would not be surprised if the octogenarian president one day proclaims Frank as his successor. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Germany's Foreign and Culture Ministries today said plans are underway to return hundreds of artifacts known as the Benin Bronzes to Nigeria. British forces looted most of the artifacts from what was then known as the Kingdom of Benin in the late 1800s, and they eventually were sold to collections around the world. The Ethnological Museum in Berlin has one of the largest collections of artifacts from the Kingdom of Benin, more than 500 items. Many Western museums have begun to assess their collections for items from former colonial states. In some cases, museums have begun returning artifacts to the states where they were made. And last of all, we are saying farewell today to VOA Africa Division Director Ngozi Mengesha, who began his journalism career in his native Ethiopia and is retiring after more than 38 years with VOA. For the last 7 years, he was director of the Africa Division. Mr. Mengesha has been a friend and mentor to many at the Africa Division. We wish him well in his new adventures away from VOA. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7. Visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great weekend.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat.
African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the International